Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Mergers and acquisitions on the program today, the courting, the proposing, and sometimes the divorcing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Ryssdal. It's Friday, everybody, May the 9th, and it's great to have you with us. This was the first line of the press release. Publicis and Omnicom agree to terminate proposed merger of equals. Big news if you care about the advertising industry, but even for those of you who could not care less about the ad business, there's that merger of equals thing to think about. Doesn't it sound nice, especially in the world of cutthroat business? Here's Marketplace's Chrissy Clark.
Hostile takeovers sound so hostile, but a merger of equals, that sounds like a happy modern marriage. And in fact, when the two advertising CEOs whose merger of equals collapsed today first announced their engagement last summer, there were flowers, adoring looks, and the Arc de Triomphe in the background. Larry Shigoris is with the Lubin School of Business.
Best friends. It looked like best friends. Big smiles. Great scenery in the back.
The ideals driving a merger of equals really are what they sound like, says Lawrence Rabiniak, emeritus professor at the Wharton School of Business.
We're both competent, we're both good, we're both capable, so let's, like adults, get together and decide how best to run this new large company that benefits from both of our sets of skills and capabilities.
But you can probably guess how this romance usually ends.
Our financial person's better than yours, or our marketing head is somehow much more aggressive and better than yours. You have divisions, politics, people pushing for one person over another to lead the show. How do I put this? There's no such thing as a merger of equals.
The only successful merger of equals that Sri Zahir, dean of the Carlson School of Management, says she's seen wasn't actually a merger of equals at all, and that helped.
Because people don't start feeling that everything has to be absolutely split down the middle.
It was when Norwest Bank acquired Wells Fargo and took its name. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Coming out of the rumor mill today are reports that Apple wants to buy Beats Electronics for $3.2 billion. Beats was started in 2008 by rapper Andre Young, better known as Dr. Dre, and it's been a pretty solid company revenue-wise. Still, $3.2 billion is a whole lot of money. We asked Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith to dig into the deal.
It's not totally clear why Apple would want to buy Beats Electronics.
D-R-E, right back up on top of things.
Beats is best known for its headphones. They're colorful, stylish, and cost about $200. Tech analyst Ben Beharin says status headphones are big business.
It's certainly clear that this is a huge growth category within retail.
Beats' revenue reportedly topped $1 billion last year. But music industry analyst Bob Lefsetz thinks Apple's interested in something else.
They certainly don't need the headphone company, which makes second-rate headphones based on marketing.
Lefsetz thinks Apple's got its eye on Beats' music streaming service. Steve Jobs famously opposed the subscription music model and championed iTunes model, where you buy a song outright.
The paradigm is shifting as I speak. Apple iTunes sales are down. Streaming revenue is up. Apple caught flat-footed. They're trying to solve this problem by buying Beats.
But Apple doesn't need to buy its way into the streaming business, says James McQuivey, a tech analyst at Forrester Research.
Subscription business is something Apple could have done by lifting a finger at any point in its history. This is not unique skill set, industry relationships, technology, none of that.
McQuivey thinks the Beats buy might be part of a larger strategy. After all, Apple is sitting on $151 billion in cash, and its shopping spree has just begun.
Dr. Dre is the name. I'm ahead of my gang still.
I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, the Dow ends the day at a new all-time high. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Seeing as it's Friday, it's time once again for our weekly wrap of what's been happening on Wall Street and elsewhere. Joining me today is Cardiff Garcia of FT Alphaville. Hey, Cardiff.
Hey, David.
And our own Lizzie O'Leary, who's recently been named host of our new show, Marketplace Weekend, which will launch next month. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, David.
I wanted to start by talking about a little bit about Beats. And Cardiff, let me go to you first. What do you make of this? What do you make of the reports that Apple's pursuing this?
Well, in addition to the reasons given for the purchase in Stacey's story just now, I'm most intrigued by the idea that Apple might be trying to give its own brand a little bit of a bump amongst young people. People forget that there's this whole generation of young adults that don't quite remember, because they weren't old enough, the miraculous leap in progress that an iPod represented on the old clunky MP3 players.
It was big,
players,
yeah.
And then an iPhone represented on the old kind of crappy cell phones that we all used to carry around. And so I think this idea that there's these young people that kind of take Apple products for granted in a sense, and they're willing to try other products if Apple doesn't keep up. And so maybe they're, you know, one of the reasons they're buying Beats is that they want to make sure that amongst young people they stay cool, they stay hip.
I'll say I think, for the record, that I'm not wearing them. Go ahead, listen.
Well, I mean, that's one of the questions, right? When you actually talk to audio experts, they're like, these headphones are not that great. But they come with some cachet, and they do come with cachet among a demographic that Apple is trying to hit, as Cardiff said, and a little bit of a ready-made customer base already there. And Apple is nothing if not a forward-thinking company. I mean, that's what they try to do, is identify new market share in terms of where they need to grow. And that is certainly a place, a demographic, where I think they would like to find a little expansion, at least in that part of their business.
All right, we'll see what happens. Lizzie, I wanted to ask you about something that's happened here in Washington. Janet Yellen, the Fed chair, has been on the Hill testifying before lawmakers, and something she kept sort of hammering home was about housing.
Yeah, she sees some pretty dark notes on housing, actually two places, on housing and on long-term unemployment. And at least my take on Janet Yellen is, you know, from a monetary policy standpoint, she's not far from Ben Bernanke at all. And that I think she's tried to telegraph. But from a communication standpoint, she's sort of somewhere between Ben Bernanke, who would often say, listen, like, this is up to you guys, Congress, this is your deal, you handle fiscal policy, and Alan Greenspan, who was basically like, everything is mine, I will wade into all areas of policy. I think she's inserting herself somewhere in the middle. And the places that she's inserting herself are both very consumer-facing. And that's different from the Fed that we've seen in the past.
Cardiff, she was giving us her sense of the economy, and something she brought up was the role of geopolitics and all of that. There's been a lot of talk, obviously, of sanctions about Russia and Ukraine. How big a deal is that? What kind of effect is that having on the economy writ large?
Look, truth be told, I think the Ukraine-Russia situation specifically isn't that big a deal yet. All right. I mean, that could always change. I think she wants to stay a little bit more aggressive than the sort of center of gravity on the FOMC, and even more aggressive than Ben Bernanke was when she took over. This is one of the reasons she can give for why it's important to keep pressing, to keep focusing on unemployment. And also on, as Lizzie said, the housing market. You know, about the housing market, she specifically said the phrase household formation growth. It's been hugely disappointing. All that really means, by the way, is young people or people of any age, really, just forming a new household and
moving
getting
out.
Yeah, getting an apartment or getting a new house. And that progress has been a lot slower than most observers expected. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Mortgages have been tough to come by. Income has been weak. Wage growth has been very low. But the point is that until that happens, it's unlikely we're going to see a lot of construction activity, a lot of progress in housing, and that's really crucial historically. That's been crucial for recoveries, for expansions, and that's part of the reason why this one hasn't accelerated quite as much as we'd hoped.
They did try to pin her down, just to jump in, on the Fed's policy options, and you know, one thing that she did sort of admit is that there aren't that many. They've tried a lot. You know, they're still kind of boxed in.
Yeah, although she is trying to slow down as much as other people would like.
All right, Cardiff Garcia there of FT Alphaville, Lizzie O'Leary, Marketplace's Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
There's a national trend to stop locking up teens as much as we used to. Instead of incarceration, it's called decarceration. Keeping kids home costs less. And one of the ways it's being done is by outfitting teens with GPS ankle monitors. Youth Radio's Sarah Quevedo reports.
17-year-old Alyssa Morris Jackson is sitting on the couch in sweatpants and a hoodie.
It's 7 o'clock right now.
She's watching the TV show Dancing with the Stars. Seven each evening is the time when about 130 other juvenile offenders in Alameda County, California, are required to plug in for their mandatory two-hour battery charge.
I'm going to be so excited to get this thing off me.
Jackson has a GPS monitor fastened around her ankle with a rubber strap. It's part of her probation. The GPS unit is black and plastic, about the size and shape of a computer mouse. Its purpose? To track her every movement. And that information ends up here.
Hello, how are you?
Here at the Juvenile Justice Center in San Leandro, California, a probation officer named Chris shows me how GPS monitors work.
We use Google Maps, and it shows real time.
The map shows the teen's path out of the building, then down the hill to the freeway.
From here, freeway, from the freeway 580.
Show him how you make it get right down.
So I can get down right to the home.
You can even tell if he's in the front yard or the backyard.
Front yard, everything.
The probation officer drags a green circle over the kid's home. It's got a radius of 150 feet. Outside of that, it'd be a GPS violation, and a judge could send him back to juvenile hall or lengthen probation. Anything outside of school and home, like a job, requires special permission at least 48 hours in advance. So it's basically house arrest.
The benefits of GPS are people are not incarcerated.
Alameda County District Attorney Nancy O'Malley says GPS also saves the county money because it costs way less than locking kids up. That's $429 a day. GPS, only $85.
So when they originally were building a new juvenile justice center, the original idea was that it was going to be more than 500 beds. And I think on any given day now, there are less than 200.
But the devices cost families money, up to $15 a day. And electronic monitoring, like GPS, has more than tripled in the last 10 years.
It is absolutely overused.
Dominique Pinckney is a public defender in Alameda County. He argues that judges assign GPS almost reflexively, even to teens who never would have been sent to juvenile hall. And he says teens get in trouble for silly reasons, like not keeping their device properly charged or hanging out with friends.
When you extend the consequence beyond some rational period, it becomes abusive, it makes kids angry, and so you engage in a battle instead of sending a corrective signal.
Nearly half of the young people who are electronically monitored end up violating the terms, according to a report by the American Bar Association. A quarter cut the device off entirely. 16-year-old Manny Velasquez is waiting outside of a courtroom. Besides his towering spiked hair, the most noticeable thing about him is the GPS monitor that's been strapped around his ankle for the past 2 months.
Sometimes I do get frustrated. I feel like I'm trapped in my own house. And just last night, I felt like the walls were closing in on me.
One courtroom away, 15-year-old Cameron Lopes just met with a judge. He was caught carrying a pocket knife in school. Now he's finishing a 30-day stint with a GPS monitor. Today, he and his dad, Jamie, were hoping to get the device taken off.
He didn't get his GPS off today.
I've been trying real hard, and they just throw all the bad stuff in, never the good stuff.
If he yelled at somebody, they brought it up, you know. They didn't bring up that he was on the honor roll and, you know, stuff like that. So another 30 days.
Judges, DAs, and public defenders are in rare agreement that GPS tracking is a good alternative to incarcerating teenagers. And it does save money. But for the young people being monitored, the technology may be solving one problem and creating others, like extending their time in the criminal justice system. In San Leandro, California, I'm Sarah Quevedo for Marketplace.
Double Charged is a year-long special investigation into the U.S. juvenile justice system that's produced by Youth Radio. Coming up,
you can just see in the footage that the people, when they're looking at him, they really think he's crazy.
Alibaba CEO Jack Ma crazy to the tune of $150 billion. But first, let's do the numbers. Decent day, not so great week. The Dow Jones Industrials picked up 0.2% or 32 points to close at 16,583, a record high. The NASDAQ added 0.5%, that's 20 points, to finish at 4071. And the S&P 500 gained 0.1%, 2 points, to close at 1878. Financial shares sat out today's climb. J.P. Morgan Chase was off 0.6%. Citigroup withdrew 0.3%. Goldman Sachs gave back 0.1%. Morgan Stanley was flat. In Europe, it was a down day. Britain's FTSE lost 0.3%, and Germany's DAX closed 0.25% lower. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.62%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, a look at the nation's balance sheet. The Treasury Department is scheduled to release its monthly statement for April. The Washington Monument reopens to the public. It's been undergoing repairs for earthquake damage since August 2011. And grab your helmet and get ready to save some bucks on gas. Bike to Work Week begins. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. We've heard a lot about Alibaba this week, the Chinese internet company. Alibaba's IPO could be one of the biggest ever, and Wall Street is drooling over the company's earning potential. One of the biggest reasons for Alibaba's success is its unconventional founder, a guy by the name of Jack Ma. He's surely one of the most powerful men in the world most people have never heard of. Well, someone who had a front row seat to Alibaba's rise was an American armed with a camera. Marketplace's China correspondent Rob Schmitz brings us this profile.
In 1995, Jack Ma was an English teacher. A friend introduced him to something called the Internet. Ma typed China in the search engine. The result? No data found. So Ma went to Beijing to try and convince China's government to create the country's first internet site. The film Crocodile in the Yangtze shows grainy footage of a floppy-haired Ma delivering his pitch to a skeptical bureaucrat.
Nowadays, foreigners can use computers from any desktop to find products from around the world. They can order directly from Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, but they can't order anything from China because right now there's nothing from China on the internet.
The film's director, Porter Erisman, says none of the officials Ma was talking to had even heard about the internet.
You can just see in the footage that the people, when they're looking at him, they really think he's crazy.
Erisman got the footage from a reporter for state-run television who thought it'd be funny to follow Ma around as he got kicked out of one government office after another.
The reason the woman was filming Jack is because she thought that here's a crazy guy who clearly is not going to go anywhere. We should record this as an example of how not to behave.
5 years later, Ma had started Alibaba, which would become the world's largest online marketplace. And Porter Erisman was the company's first foreign employee. At the time, eBay set its sights on China. And Erisman said Jack Ma used his background as a student of martial arts to engage the Western giant.
One of the key principles in martial arts is that you can use an opponent's strength against them. And so when we looked at eBay with their big advertising campaign, we realized there was a way to use that advertising to help promote Taobao.
Taobao, Alibaba's shopping site, launched an aggressive media campaign attacking eBay and questioning which company was better for China. The strategy worked. Every time eBay ran a local ad, it got people thinking about this new Chinese shopping site, Taobao. eBay eventually pulled out of China, and Taobao is a big reason Alibaba is expected to raise billions from investors when it goes public. And that's despite Jack Ma's attitude towards Wall Street, which he shared with Alibaba employees at a company event in Porter Erisman's film.
Let the Wall Street investors curse us if they want. We will still follow the principle of customers first, employees second, and investors third.
Given the potential return on investment for owning Alibaba's stock, playing third fiddle shouldn't be a problem for Wall Street. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
We've got clips from that movie up at marketplace.org. The time you spend in a grocery store, the more you notice certain buzzwords on everything, from produce to cereal boxes. Words like organic, phrases like GMO-free. Mark Bittman, in his column for the New York Times this week, raises some questions about whether we use those words too much and if they've lost some of their nuance. Bittman is the author of several books on cooking and vegetarianism and veganism, and we've got him on the line. Hi, Mark. It's good to talk to you.
Hey there, David.
I sort of waded into these waters myself a couple of months back. My wife and I have a young daughter. She's drinking cow's milk now, and we went to the store to pick out a quart of milk, and there was organic milk. There was milk that wasn't organic, but it was hormone-free. There was milk that was all natural. And I guess we felt like, you know, we really have this sort of limited sense of what those terms mean.
It's pretty funny, isn't it? Because I don't know how old you are, but when I was a kid, you went and bought milk. What happens to me in interviews a lot is I say things like, we should be eating more fruits and vegetables, we should be eating fewer animal products, we should be eating less junk. And the interviewer says, see, you're not doing this because I'm not letting you talk. But the interviewer says, but what if people can't afford to eat organic? And it becomes a complete red herring. It's not as if that really needs to enter the conversation. The question should be, can people afford to eat better? And for 80 or 90% of the people in the United States, the answer to that is yes.
And you write, the argument that you make is that you don't necessarily have to go to a Whole Foods. You don't have to buy organic. You don't have to spend a lot of money to eat better.
That is exactly the argument I make. And if people can't afford to buy real food, that's not a question of whether the real food is organic or not. That's a, you know, that becomes an income question, not even a quality of food question almost.
When it comes to GMOs, I think what scares a lot of people, Mark, is that there are still things that are unknown about the process. And I just wonder, is that a fear without merit?
Well, I mean, I couldn't explain to you how electricity works, and I doubt, you know, more than 1% of the population could explain it to either of us. I think GMOs kind of stink, and I don't think they've been demonstrated to do much benefit. I'm just saying this is not something we need to be afraid of, and to focus on this to the exclusion of, say, antibiotics in our food supply is a mistake. How do we eat better? It's not enough to say, I'm going organic or I hate GMOs. We need to have a way to express these things that allow for a little more flexibility and a little more nuance.
Do you worry about the nuances associated with the term veganism, or could that go down the same path?
I do think the word vegan is problematic because it has come to imply healthy. But, of course, you can eat Oreos and Coke all day long and be vegan. I mean, and be probably pretty unhealthy. So we like code words. We like slogans. We tend to move in that direction. But eating vegan does not necessarily mean you're eating better. Eating better means eating less junk food, fewer animal products, more plant products. It's pretty simple, but it's not one word.
Mark Bittman's a columnist for the New York Times. His most recent book is the VB6 Cookbook, the Vegan Before 6 Cookbook. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, David. Nice talking with you.
Graduation season is upon us. There are caps and gowns, there's pomp and circumstance, and of course, there are the celebrity commencement speakers. This year, Sean Diddy Combs is one of them. He got an invite from Howard University here in Washington to address graduates and to pick up an honorary degree. And that's drawn no small share of criticism, in part because Diddy dropped out of Howard back in 1990. But Christina Coleman with the website Global Grind says even though he didn't graduate, it's important to hear what Combs has to say.
Moguls, icons, and millionaires like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates were all welcomed back to their unofficial alma maters after dropping out of school. But Combs, who many readily accept to host a party or give a shout-out, is somehow shelled out of the realm of successful individuals who have made it without higher education. America, you can't be that selective. If we are to teach hip-hop in universities, we can certainly have one of its most successful moguls speak to our students, no? What makes Combs' story so special wasn't his rise to the top as a dropout. It's his rise to the top as a black man who dropped out. And frankly, if we're to compare Jobs, Gates, and Combs, let's get one thing clear. Their starting points were not the same. There's this thing called privilege. Combs perfected the art of business, his Sean John clothing line, the unprecedented Revolt TV, the Vote or Die campaign that bolstered the numbers of young voter registration and led to Barack Obama's presidential win. Howard University is still at the helm of that success. Isn't demonizing and excluding Combs from academia for his musical content or because he didn't make his money as a lawyer or doctor a nuanced way to say this subset of black culture isn't good enough for Howard University? Howard does need someone suggesting to its African-American graduates that he couldn't have made it without the knowledge he acquired at the esteemed college. And possibly, insight to navigating this faux post-racial world as educated black people. And for that, I'm certain Bill Gates and Steve Jobs couldn't provide any insight or advice.
You can read Christina Coleman's entire essay at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, if you're buying real estate, you should probably come with bags of cash. More and more people seem to be doing that, at least. Last quarter, a third of the existing homes sold were purchased entirely in cash. Who's buying them this way? Well, retirees, foreign investors, and Americans who can, who don't want to bother with trying to get a mortgage, something that, as Cardiff pointed out earlier, is still pretty tough. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yor. It's produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm David Gura. Kai Rizdal, be back on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.